Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with John DeSantis, author, and James Loisel, photographer, about the Thibodeau Massacre, racial violence, and the 1887 sugarcane strike. We'll also hear from novelist Chris Tusa, author of City of Falling Stars. Award-winning journalist John DeSantis is the senior staff writer for the Times of Houma. He's the author of For the Color of His Skin, The Murder of Yusef Hopkins, and The Trial of Bensonhurst, and The New Untouchables, How America Sanctions Police Violence. For his new book, he's gone deep into Louisiana history. It's called The Thibodeau Massacre, Racial Violence and the 1887 Sugarcane Labor Strike. With him is James Loisel, who's a Houma photographer. So John and James, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you for having us, Susan.
Thank you.
I see, John, that your first two books grew out of your experience in New York and your background in criminal justice. So what's your Louisiana story? How'd you get to Thibodeau?
I got blown to Houma by Hurricane Andrew. After I had published For the Color of His Skin, I decided I wanted to live in New Orleans in a garret in the French Quarter and write short stories no one would read until after I died. And I kind of did that.
Oh, you did?
And I discovered Terrebonne Parish because I was doing some coverage of Hurricane Andrew for the Washington Post. And I met the most amazing people in Terrebonne Parish. A few years later, I tried to think about what I wanted to do when I grew up, and I got tired of working with the homicide du jour and went to learn stories from the commercial fishermen and to write about them, and I got a job working for The Courier, which is a newspaper in Houma.
Wow, that's a lot of geography for you to cover in a short period of time. So what drew you to this particular story? Because your earlier books have been more contemporaneous, and this is really a deep dive back into Louisiana history.
After a few years, when I'd been working in Houma, doing a lot of criminal justice-related stories and so on, I heard people talk about something having happened in Thibodeau. I didn't know a whole lot about it. People would say, did you ever hear of the Thibodeau Massacre? And I would have to say no. So I did a little bit of research and found that there was an unknown number of people who were killed, that it somehow involved a strike, and that nobody had ever been brought to justice. For many years during my time here, when I would work in Thibodeau, when I would visit families, I would ask them, had you heard about something that happened way back where people were killed and people left? And most people would say, no, I've never heard of that. And so there was some good scholarly work that had been done on this incident, and I had talked with my editors at that time and said, someday we're going to tell this story. And last year, after the tragedy in Charleston at Mother Emanuel, mm-hmm. working for the Times, my feeling was that if America is beginning to truly have a racial dialogue, maybe we need to tell this story in the newspaper. And I talked with Brian Rushing, who owns the paper, and I had talked with Shel Armstrong, who was the editor, and I said, I want to tell this story. And I did in the newspaper as best as I could at the time, because most of what I had to work with was the scholarship that had already been done. And after the story ran in the Times, Amanda Earle, who is an acquisitions editor at the History Press, had contacted me and said, we'd like to have a book on this thing that you've written about. Do you know anyone that would be interested? And I said yes.
Now, one of the things that's so fascinating about this story is that it's got a long buildup. I mean, Louisiana during Reconstruction was such a turbulent place. And so much of the conflicting energies to set this event in motion were building up over this long, long period of time, weren't they?
Yes, indeed. They'd been building up from when the Jesuits first brought sugar to Louisiana.
Right.
It was one of the issues with trying to decide how to tell this story was how far back do we go? And I thought of my friends in New York and my friends on the West Coast and people who could not even pronounce Thibodeau.
Of course. And let alone spell it.
Exactly. That may still be a challenge for some people. And I had thought about it and said, no, we need to go all the way back. We need to explain to people what sugar is, that it comes from sugar cane.
Right.
We needed to explain then how slavery enters into the picture. Slavery, although the massacre occurred 25 years after emancipation, slavery and the culture that had been was still very important to this whole deadly cocktail of
events.
Well,
these people were slaves in every way except in name, right?
They were, and that situation continued well after this.
Right. And they were asking, these workers were asking for such a modest increase in wages. It's really shocking when you contemplate it from today's viewpoint.
And the wages were not even as important to them as the plantation scrip and doing away with that. They wanted, in most cases, $1 a day for regular work, and they wanted $1.25 for what was called watch. And that was when you would work during the grinding season, especially all night long, processing sugar and bringing it in and doing what needed to be done, because these were huge operations, some of them.
And once you've seen the sugar harvest kind of in motion, you never forget it. It's a very visual thing, too.
It is, very much.
Amazing. So what was the last straw that led to the violence that occupies most of this book?
Well, there was a prelude to the last straw, which was that, well, of course, there was the strike. And the strike began right around this time of year. And the strike had started in October, late September. Early October. And it was an amazing strike because you had thousands of sugarcane workers who said, we're not going to work. They laid down their tools. And this was unheard of, and especially something of this magnitude. And so many things happened during the course of that month. From New Orleans, the state militia had been sent in by General Beauregard, specifically at the request of the governor, Governor McGinnery. And the militia had come to Thibodeau. They had put a Gatling gun up on the courthouse steps, and they assisted with the evictions from the plantations. Those who would not work could not stay.
Right.
The judges signed orders. And the military assisted with the evictions. Well, then you had thousands and thousands of displaced people who had all come to Thibodeau. And that started some problems, and that started some friction. And there was a tremendous amount of fear among the white people who lived in Thibodeau. Many were making livings in one way or another related to the sugar cane fields. Well, the militia left. Their job was done. They needed to get back to their homes. There was a Lafourche Parish militia. And they remained, of course. They were under the command of Lieutenant Governor Knobloch. On the morning of November 23rd, two pickets, that is, guards who were keeping the town closed. Judge Taylor Beatty had ordered the town closed, nobody in, nobody out. Two of the volunteer guards who were on duty just before daybreak were shot at. Nobody knows by who. And then, after those shots were fired, after those two men was injured, that is when the stampede began.
And you open this book with this terrifying scene of a man trapped under a house with gunfire echoing all around. And this character seems to particularly call to you, and his name is Jack Conrad. I wonder if you'd tell us about him.
My friend Jack Conrad, we've gotten to know each other very well over this past year. Jack Conrad, he started out as a slave in Lafourche Parish, and in 1862, when the Union Army was occupying Thibodaux, he, like many other men like him, joined the United States Colored Infantry. He fought in the war. He stayed the length of the war and then returned to New Orleans, where he had joined up. Then he went back to Lafourche Parish, continued working on the plantations, and did well for himself, got a house in town, lived there with his family. And Jack was injured in the massacre. His son was killed. His son was one of the ones murdered. And Jack, unlike many of the other victims whose names we were able for the first time to determine, Jack had a history because of his military service. Jack's pension file contains affidavits with first person accounts from people who witnessed this. It contains a first person account from Jack Conrad. And the reason this was written in such a vivid way in the beginning is that what we ended up with, quite unexpectedly, was the first ever voices of African American people speaking to what happened in 1887. And that happens because of Jack Conrad.
And those passages are so strong. I mean, they're just, you're right there with them. Now, one of the things that I love about History Press books is that they come to life with all these photographs. And you have amazing photographs in this book that document sugarcane culture and the lives of people working in the cane. But you also have some more contemporary photographs. And James took some of those photographs for you. So what was it like for you to revisit those places, knowing what they meant now?
It was a learning experience for me.
So is this your first book you've worked on?
My first, yes.
Ah. Well, good job. That's all I can say. So I wonder what you think, John. I wonder if you think there are other stories like this that are waiting to be told. I mean, I think of the Colfax Massacre, which came to life so vividly in Lolita Tatamy's novel. So do you think there are lots more stories like this in Louisiana culture that we haven't properly excavated?
Oh, yes. There were hints of stories that I was able to find while working on this. One of the things that I found of interest in that regard was that in Lafourche Parish itself, there were things that occurred other than this event in 1887. At some point after Reconstruction and prior to that time, there were hints of things, and I say this because families that I spoke with that began opening up talked of things that would have been more akin to what we would regard as traditional lynchings that had occurred that nobody had ever spoken about. And so we make some mention in the book of some indications of these, and I have to believe, because of the climate, especially Reconstruction and post-Reconstruction, that I am sure that as we dig, as we look forward, we're going to unfortunately find more evidence of more things in some of our communities.
Afraid so. We've been talking with John DeSantis, whose new book is The Thibodaux Massacre, Racial Violence in the 1887 Sugarcane Labor Strike, along with photographer James Loisel. You can meet John Tuesday, November 22nd at 6 at Octavia Books. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It is a great pleasure to welcome Chris Tusa to The Reading Life. Chris teaches creative writing at Louisiana State University and is the writer in residence at Southeastern Louisiana University. busy man. He's the author of a novel, Dirty Little Angels, and a collection of poems, Haunted Bones. Today, we're talking about his second novel, In the City of Falling Stars. So, Chris Dusso, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks for having me.
Now, The City of Falling Stars takes place in a landscape that's all too familiar to a lot of us. It's post-Katrina New Orleans, and it's the story of a family that's coming apart. So, what's going on with the Delahousses?
Well, they're a dysfunctional bunch, and I wanted to, you know, have an interracial relationship in New Orleans because I wanted to sort of contemporize the South. I read so many Southern novels that have this antiquated notion of what the South is, so I wanted to sort of update it and modernize it. So they're an interracial relationship. I don't get into it much, but he's had a history of mental illness, and his wife works at a local TV station. And they have two children that are kind of struggling through adolescence, Audrey and Brandon. And Vivian has had an affair. She's now pregnant. She and Maurice have separated. And Maurice, in trying to kind of grapple with what's going on, oftentimes clings to things and obsesses about things to sort of distract himself from his life. And he's starting to do that now. And so he's sort of glued to the news. Katrina has happened. He's hearing lots of stories of things that are suspicious to him, formaldehyde in trailers and water not drinkable and possible explosions, you know, heard after Katrina had passed of the levee. And so he sort of puts all these things together and begins obsessing on them and gradually starts to kind of put together this idea that there's a conspiracy in New Orleans.
So this is a family that's undergoing every possible kind of stress, you know?
Yeah.
So I have to say, Maurice's conspiracy theories, they do sort of strike a nerve.
Yeah.
I mean, he has this obsession with birds falling out of the sky.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you remember it, but there's this wonderful story by Kellyanne Gartman about suicidal angels.
Oh, really?
That angels had come to New Orleans to help out after Katrina, and they were so overwhelmed, they were just always dropping out of the sky.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of that going around at that time period.
Yeah, it all started when I heard of an incident where flocks of birds had fallen from the sky on the outskirts of Baton Rouge in rural Louisiana in the 60s that happened, and it happened again more recently than that. But I heard about that, and the real kind of impetus for the whole book was in New Orleans. And some friends and I get together every year for a friend's birthday, and we have what's called a superhero crawl. And we dress up like superheroes, and we crawl down Magazine on bikes and, you know, stopping off at different bars. And a black woman on a porch not too far from where we were, I was talking to her, and she was saying, you know, it's just terrible what's happened in New Orleans, and, you know, with everything going on with 9/11 and the war and what happened in New Orleans, and now this talk of, you know, levees maybe being exploded and formaldehyde in the trailers. And she said, you know, it just makes you think that someone's pulling the strings somewhere in this city. And I started just kind of thinking about, well, what if someone really thought that to the point that they would make, you know, decisions on a daily basis based on that? And I was kind of partly raised by a black woman, and I grew up in a neighborhood where there were lots of black and white kids, and I oftentimes found myself relating more to the black kids than the white kids for a lot of reasons, or at least I was more interested in what they were doing and how they were living. And I'd written poems from the perspectives of Marie Laveau and people like that, so I'd kind of started doing that when I wrote poetry. But I really wanted to write a book about what was happening at that time, and I really didn't feel like the perspective needed to be someone who was white. And so I wanted it to be a narrator, not in first person, obviously, but black narrator, so I could take that perspective because I felt like it, in a lot of ways, impacted poor black people a lot more than it did, at least in my experiences, you know, wealthy white people. And I also wanted to put this character not in that neighborhood, but in a place where he'd kind of left that neighborhood in this new marriage that he had. So, and I also wanted to talk briefly about race in New Orleans, not, you know, to where I was actually commenting on it, but where I was actually having characters, you know, deal with whatever they were dealing with. And I wanted, hopefully, you know, I wanted there to be moments of comedy, too. I didn't want it to be my first book. When we were shopping around with my agent, I think Dial Press was interested, and they said it was oppressively dark.
So. Well, there's a lot of comedy in this book. There's a lot to leaven all this. I mean, just the whole idea that Maurice, you know, mired in all these conspiracy theories, is insurance person.
Yeah, he was really funny. I haven't had more fun ever writing about a character as a different with Maurice. I mean, he was fun.
Yeah. So did you have any reservations about taking on that time period or using that setting?
Well, I didn't want to do it for at least, I told myself, a decade. I didn't want to touch it for a while because I really felt, I mean, I teach at LSU in Southeastern, but I was born and raised here, and, you know, New Orleans is like a person to me. When I watched what happened to the city on the news and heard from friends and stuff, I mean, I wept. I mean, I was upset. felt like a person, you know, that I knew had died. And so I sort of grieved through it a little bit. And then I saw lots of books that were coming out, you know, from people who lived here and people who didn't. And I just didn't really want to, you know, it appears if I was sort of jumping on that train. I mean, I didn't have a problem with people who did, but I really didn't feel like I wanted to do it and I didn't feel comfortable doing it. So I wanted to wait for a while before I wrote anything about it. And then when I finally decided to write about it, I wanted to portray New Orleans as it was, but I wanted also there to be some element of comedy because, you know, think about New Orleans that a lot of people don't know that don't live here is that, you know, we're fun people. I mean, they see these things in brochures and they hear about it, but we're fun people in general. But in a lot of times when we have these tragedies, that's when the humor really comes out. I mean, we sort of celebrate our dysfunction and we kind of find ways to celebrate things that maybe aren't worth celebrating. I mean, you know, we have jazz funerals. I mean, it's...
Right.
So... I wanted there to be comedy in it for that reason. I felt like there needed to be some element of humor in it because that just kind of reflects New Orleans, I guess.
Well, a lot of the humor comes from the Delahousse kids.
Yeah.
And you know what they say about kids and animals.
Yeah.
But really, the daughter, Audrey, yeah. who is a Tulane student, yeah. provides so much comic relief. The mouth on that girl.
Yeah. It was fun to write her, too, because, you know, she has all this angst toward her mom, mostly because she, you know, she knows she's like her, but has all this angst toward her mom. And then, you know, she's going through that period that we all go through at that age when we sort of think we've figured out everything and we have all the answers and we've realized our parents are completely wrong and we have seen the light. And that's a fun time to write about, especially if you're an adult now and you can look back on that. I think the anger and the tension of the family was really the funnest part of the book because that was where I could actually show that anger in dialogue. And the book's really dialogue heavy. I mean, it's more dialogue heavy than I usually write. But that's what I mean, I felt like I had so many opportunities to have fun with the dialogue.
And then there's one character in this book who will live on forever as one of the great New Orleans eccentric characters, and that is the family patriarch Virgil.
Yeah.
And his post-Katrina experience
yeah.
is quite hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, and it was strange because, you know, I have a lot of people read what I've written before I do anything with it. And then lots of times I'll revise or just kind of get ideas from them. And at the end of the book, I realized I could have really had a very successful book if I would have written from Virgil's perspective because everyone just loved him. I mean, it was like one of those characters that, you know, that you hope you write one day where every reader keeps saying how much they like him and... But it was fun to write about him because there were so many Virgils in my life at that time who were talking to me and telling me what had happened and where they were. And he was a great fixture in the family because he sort of had a lot in common with Audrey in how he sees the world and how he sort of comments on it. And, you know, Vivian has sort of set this family up to be not like that, you know, to be sort of sophisticated and quiet and intellectual and so. And Virgil's none of those things. So,
well, we should say that Virgil lost his home in Lakeview and is tucked away in a nursing home.
Yeah.
And is about to get into trouble for
yeah.
too much action in the nursing home.
Yeah, right. And then I thought it was funny, too, to have somebody who wanted to stay in this nursing home simply because he couldn't deal with his son's wife. Early on, you know, I had this character Maurice, who I thought was really funny, and when he started having, you know, these kind of visions of Jesus, I started thinking, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if he were Jewish and
yes.
a black Jewish man in New Orleans who's suddenly seen visions of Jesus? I thought that would be a really great. So really, it became this fun process of like just adding to the character, and it wasn't long before, as I was writing him, I knew what he would say, which is always a good sign.
Yeah,
if you have an idea and you know it doesn't work because the character wouldn't say that, that's always a good sign. But it hasn't happened that many times to me, but it happened with him and Virgil, too. I mean, some of the characters really kind of came to life for me, at least. I knew
well,
they were.
There is so much spiritual comedy in this, which is another
yeah.
New Orleans specialty, you
yeah.
know? So how are you feeling now, 11 years out after Katrina, having written this book? How does New Orleans work as a muse for you now?
It's tough because, you know, I have a job that I love and where I'm sort of respected and I'm happy with in Baton Rouge at LSU and Southeastern. And I sort of have things set up really, really well for myself to kind of keep writing and do what I want to do and to teach. But I've always wanted to live here again. I mean, I can't believe that I haven't lived here since 2003. I mean, I come down here and it's like I just don't want to go back. I mean, my wife's really happy with Baton Rouge too, and she's happy with our living situation. But I see her point about, you know, wanting to live where we live, but it never leaves me. I mean, I'm trying to write a novel right now that's not necessarily set anywhere, and it's just so hard for me not to just grab onto New Orleans because it just seems mm-hmm. so much a part of who I am, you know?
Well, it permeates your work, and,
yeah.
and you're so accomplished as a poet as well. I mean, where's your heart? Is your heart in novels? Or?
Yeah, fiction for sure. I mean, I started at Southeastern with Tim Gautreaux before I went to Florida for my MFA. And even my poems, a lot of times, for the most part, were dramatic monologues. They were stories. And yeah, I think in stories. You know, I mean, that's because I grew up in New Orleans on a porch, you know, talking to people. But I would be shocked if I ever wrote another book of poetry. I mean, I would be.
Wow.
I haven't written a poem in years. I just really want to write fiction. And I don't think I started out as successful in fiction as I did in poetry, because I kind of figured poetry out a little bit more over time. But that's kind of what draws me to it, is that
you're still
I don't have it
out.
Exactly figured out. And yeah, my writing's getting better, but it's not exactly where I want it to be yet. And another thing, too, is, you know, I'd go to bookstores and the carpet in front of the poetry section was brand new because nobody had been there. I mean, you know, after you write a book of poetry and you've published in a lot of places and you realize you have like four readers, I mean, it's horrible. I wanted an audience. Like,
I'm going to start checking out the carpet
it really
patterns
is.
Now.
It's
Whoa.
Brand new because there's just the Shakespeare and there's, you know, there's Maya Angelou. And I mean, it's, you know, it's getting smaller and smaller each year. And, you know, with fiction, it's just so nice because, I mean, I constantly get emails from people about, you know, my characters and the stories and how much they like them. And, you know, when you say what you do, you don't have to have that reaction that people have when you say you're a poet and they just look at you like, what did you just say? People read fiction, you know. So I wanted an audience and I wanted to be able to share it with people and, like, to talk about it and to have signings and readings and all those things. So, yeah.
All the good things that come
yeah,
after
I'm
all
I'm more
those...
comfortable with fiction, I think, now.
Yeah. All those years of writing alone, you want to step
yeah,
out
I'm not
and
real
see somebody
solitary,
read your
yeah.
book.
I'm not very poetish, so.
We've been talking with Chris Tusa, whose new novel is City of Falling Stars. Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Suzanne Peyton signs Virginia's Diary, Tuesday, November 22nd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, John DeSantis, signs The Thibodeau Massacre, Racial Violence, and the 1887 Sugar Cane Strike, Tuesday, November 22nd at 6 at Octavia Books. Johnette Downing celebrates the publication of three new children's books, Petit Pierre and the Floating Marsh, Today is Monday in Louisiana in board book form, and Down in Mississippi. Mississippi, Saturday, November 26th at 11:30 at Maple Street Bookshop. Deb Burst signs Spirits of the Bayou, Sanctuary, Cemeteries, and Hauntings, Saturday, November 26th from 1 to 3 at Maple Street Bookshop. Today's guest, Chris Tusa, signs City of Falling Stars, Monday, November 28th at 6 at Octavia Books. Poet Elizabeth Gross celebrates the release of her new chapbook, The Escape Artist, as well as her birthday, along with writers Anya Groner and Carius Henderson, Tuesday, November 29th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. And don't forget to buy local and shop small. The Saturday after Thanksgiving, you can visit almost any indie bookstore in New Orleans and find area authors working there to recommend books for holiday giving. Watch for Yvonne Spear Perrette talking about and signing Simone of New Orleans from 11 to 1 at Octavia Books. And here's some good news. Crescent City Books announces a new publishing imprint, CCB, with sister store Commonwealth Books. After publishing poetry, CCB is now venturing into New Orleans prose, written in a fresh style and voice. For more information, visit Crescent City Books or write CCB submissions at gmail.com. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.